to A Conspiracy of Lemurs, a Regal House publishing podcast that celebrates the writing craft. Co-hosted by myself, Janie Royal, founder and editor-in-chief at Regal House Publishing, and the editorial genius, Pam Van Dyke, Regal's managing editor. We are thrilled today to welcome two of our Regal House authors, Jen Alexander and Karen Quivillon, to discuss geography and landscape in literature, stories in which place plays a significant role. We've got tons of exciting things to talk about today, and we look forward to jumping into it. But first of all, Pam, would you care to introduce our guests?
Jan Alexander lives in New York and spent about 10 years dividing her time between New York, Hong Kong, and China. Her novel, Miss Ming's Guide to Civilization, was a Leapfrog Fiction Prize semifinalist. She is the author of a previous novel, Getting to Lama, co-author of Bad Girls of the Silver Screen, and editor-at-large for the literary magazine New World Review. She has written about business and travel for many publications and taught Chinese history at Brooklyn College. Welcome, Jan.
Thank you, Pam. Great to be here.
Karen Quivillon began seriously writing fiction a little over a decade ago and has published short stories, creative nonfiction, and poetry in many literary journals. She has a PhD in philosophy from Northwestern University and two master's degrees and works as an adjunct professor as well as a writing coach. A bookworm and nature lover, Karen grew up in small town Ontario. At various times, she's lived in Toronto, Chicago, Paris, London, and Montreal. She currently resides in Oakville. Welcome, Karen.
Thanks, Pam. Great to be here.
You know, thinking about place in literature, when I think of the novels that I love, it's not the plot that comes to mind, or even necessarily the characters, but the setting. They can be real places, you know, the twisted, narrow streets of old London, so brilliantly represented in Dickens's novels, or the pastoral landscapes so critical to Thomas Hardy's work. Or the setting might be entirely imaginative, like the war-torn world ruled by superstates as portrayed in George Orwell's 1984. When it comes to setting a novel in a particular place, whether it be actual or imaginative, I wonder what informs the author's decisions in this regard. Jen, I'd love to start with you if you have some thoughts on this.
What informs my decisions about place? Places I've been to a large extent. My novel, Ms. Ming's Guide to Civilization, is of course very much about a place, and the place is China, and for the most part, a remote Sichuan village in China. The novel began around a visit to a very similar village. The village, or in the novel, I call the village Sunshine Village. That's a fictionalized name. I mean, my thoughts about place are that I couldn't even start writing fiction until I saw places I really wanted to see, until I really felt like I had established some sense of where I really wanted to be in the world and where I really wanted to go, because place is that important. If I had just stayed in a place where I came from, I came from a couple of different places. My family moved around a bit, but that wasn't enough. I really wanted to experience New York. I really wanted to experience China, and I couldn't really start writing fiction until I'd immersed myself in both places.
Did you visit villages in China, which you utilize as a setting for Sunshine Village, Jan, or is it a loose amalgamation of places you've been and sites you've seen?
Sunshine Village was very much based on a particular village. I've been to a lot of rural Chinese villages, and each one is pretty unique. Each one pretty much has a character of its own. I really did have to immerse myself in this Sichuan village in order to get a sense of its character. It was a village where, don't laugh, but it was kind of ghostly. I mean, it's a character in itself with a lot of emotional baggage. It had changed many times due to politics, due to nature, due to the inhabitants. And I had to get a sense of all of that. And then once I did that, and I started writing this novel that I knew was going to take place to a large extent in this village, I turned the village into something entirely different in my imagination. I turned it into a utopia, even if it isn't a utopia that lasts forever. I suddenly became I mean, I guess I kind of channeled Thomas More and invented an imaginary place that I would like it to be, a place far away that is the kind of place where I'd really like to live.
Yes, I think there's also something really attractive about utilizing a narrative setting that has been relatively neglected by previous imaginative eyes. I mean, I can't imagine that there, or at least not many that I have read, are of novels that are set in rural Chinese villages. And I think that really makes for an engaging setting, Jan, because it is new to most readers. For your novel too, Karen, in writing about Kuala Kangsar in British Malaya, that's a territory of humanity and place that has scarcely been covered by other novelists. Was this something that you found appealing in the penning of The Parasol Flower?
Yeah. Now, unlike Jan, where I start with place was from books. I have not been there. I've not been to Malaysia. And I was doing a lot of research about this colonial era just in Southeast Asia and the sort of dynamics between the British households or in other contexts, the Dutch households and the natives who became servants. And it sparked something in me, an interest to try to approach that intimate space through storytelling, through a novel. And so I did more research. I decided to set it in British Malaya rather than some of the other colonial contexts that were not English, simply because I had more of a background in English history and, you know, speak English and so forth. So I ended up having done a lot of research, created in my imagination a space and a place and a time, and could see it quite vividly. I'm sure it's different in you know, probably completely different were I to visit Kuala Kangsar now. And yet somehow I felt emboldened to continue because it was set in the past and it's 1896 and nobody else could say, you got that wrong. And so I just proceeded kind of recklessly based on other people's books and other people who had been there and recorded their experiences and what they saw and felt and smelled and so forth.
I love that you channeled, you know, a real sense of the British colonial mindset in Malaya at the time, Karen. That just seemed so authentic based on remnants I've seen in Asia.
Yeah, thank you. I mean, that's probably because I was reading those sources, you know, their recordings at the time. So it has that flavor, right, of their impressions.
Your novel, Jan, Miss Ming's Guide to Civilization, is built on a strong sense of place, with both New York and Beijing and, of course, Sunshine Village forming the backdrop to narrative action. But, of course, the spirit of place in a novel is not just an inert backdrop or a straightforward illustration of emotions. It's part of the humanity at the center of the endeavor. And how does this use of place influence and inform the characters in your novel, Jan?
Well, I think the characters are very much products of their place, wherever that place might be. Ming, as she starts out, Ming starts out born in Sunshine Village. Would you like me to read a couple of passages that illustrate place and how it affects Ming when she's a child and then when she's a teenager and she's left Sunshine Village?
That would be wonderful.
Okay, well, I'll read from the very beginning, which is an introduction to the place of Sunshine Village. Ming Cheng was born in the cruelest place on earth, a village that sprawled through six green hills, so far out west in Sichuan province that the maps had no names for what was there. The village lay beneath a dome of clouds, with rain that could bite right through her clothes. Hardly anyone came through, and no one left. A bus was supposed to pass through town once a week, but many days it couldn't get through the clouds and was forced to take another route. Ming's town was called Yangguang, or Sunshine Village, and everyone thought that was a mean joke. Mama and Papa said the sun used to shine there, though. They could tell from the deep gorge where the Tuo River ran that a million years ago the rains had made a mighty river. Then the sun had dried it out, then the rains had come, then the sun, then the rains had come again and carved a deep riverbed, then the sun again, and then the rain. That's a short passage, and I can read another short passage that takes place when Ming is a little older, and she's in another place. For years afterward, Ming dreamt of riding a roller coaster to the sun, and in some ways she actually did. When Ming was 11, the Sunshine Village Communist Party officials granted some of the other scientist neighbors who'd come there to work in the silicon factory permission to move back to the cities they'd come from. Mama and Papa discovered that if they saved some money and gave it in an envelope to the local party, they too could get permission. When Ming was 12, they moved to the bustling city of Beijing. Ming didn't mind climbing the 7 floors to their new big city apartment or dodging the million bicycles and cars when crossing the streets, nor did she mind the chemicals in the air that felt like needles piercing her nostrils. She could look above the tall buildings and see a yellowish sphere of sun, even on days when pollution made the air a chalky, gray-white color. Ming loved looking in the stores with their glass cases full of medicinal mushrooms and herbs, bins of wrapped white candy, and headless mannequins wearing dresses. She loved Beijing, even though she didn't have many friends at her new school. The girls laughed at her, and she'd heard them sneer in their haughty Mandarin at her ragged country clothes. In school, Ming read a story translated from English about a group of writers who lived in America, in a place called New York City. Someday, she decided, she was going to find a way to get on a plane and get beyond even Beijing, to the city in America where everyone wanted to be a writer. So that's an early depiction of where Ming starts and where she goes and where she wants to go. So in each place, you know, there's something in the place that begins to shape her. And she very much wants to go to New York because she knows that it will help shape her as a writer, and that's what she most wants to do. And she runs up against a lot of conflict over that. But the place is critical. The place is really a character in its own right, as I see it.
It's also interesting, Jan, with your characters, because they individually aspire to be in certain places and to look at their emotional feelings about those locations before they've gone, and then to seeing how the characters evolve and develop after spending time in that place, and how their perspectives change and their characters evolve, and how place really informs that change, I think is really interesting and captured very well in your novel.
I tried. Traveling was very important to this novel, too. How would I write this novel right now? That's, if I may put in a plug, I think it's a good novel to read if you are, you know, unable to travel right now, because it'll take you to a lot of different places. And when I think about it, I think, oh, wow, all those places I went, I wish I could go there now, because it would help me evolve. You know, now that we're all kind of stuck in a certain place, I think one of the things I most miss is the way you can go somewhere and it will continue to shape you, no matter how old you are.
Well, Karen, I think it's really interesting in The Parasol Flower that you have two points of view, Hannah Inglis, who is living in turn of the century British Malaya, and Nancy Roach, who's in a contemporary character, contemporary point of view. But the POVs alternate somewhat, and then there are other POV characters as well. But I feel that I could feel Nancy Roach's character beginning to immerse herself in the culture of British Malaysia by looking through, doing her research into Hannah Inglis. And I think it's really interesting to have a contemporary point of view looking back in history at a place she has not visited, although she does eventually go there. You know, I was thinking about Nancy Roach's character in particular, and how do you feel moving her from place to place to place changed her perspective in the end, changed the character's perspective in the end?
I think it's an important aspect of that character that she is outside of place in a way. She's nomadic almost. So she's been living in the United States for her schoolwork, but has left and gone to Paris, and then ends up in London as well. And shortly after that, and is immersing herself in the past. So she's you know, in Asia in the past. And so her character is really informed by this being outside of anyone. She's not rooted. She doesn't feel like she belongs, or rather she's seeking out some sort of belonging that isn't attached necessarily to a particular local community. So she finds belonging with Hannah, right? With this artist and what she's trying to accomplish, and with the search for that as well. So that's what gives her comfort and the feeling of having a connection and being inspired and having a relationship with someone who she's never going to meet, but who has, you know, left her these clues and these works of art. And I loved exploring that, actually, how there are, how we can have these relationships and this feeling of connection to people we are never going to be able to talk to, but, you know, might only, you know, see in print, like see their words, you know, hundreds of years later and hear their voice through those words, or, you know, with a painting, have a sense of who the artist is by what the way in which they're portraying their world. And that fascinates me. So I enjoyed having Nancy sort of creating her own community in a way. Hannah is also one who she's in Kuala Kangsa, but she's not of it. And same with, you know, the expat characters who have come to this land. It's not theirs. They're, you know, in various ways, they're sort of, depending on their attitude, they're suffering from, you know, the heat, or they're complaining about the humidity or the natives or the inconvenience of this or that. And Hannah is not like that. She's embracing it all. But it is, in a way, it is her, but it's new to her as well. So she's exploring and becoming of that land. It's not a place where she grew up, obviously, but it's a place that she becomes attached to through the ways in which she interacts with the people there and with the natural world there. Yeah, both of those characters are really, there is this disjunct between sort of their sense of who they are and where they find themselves. And there's this journey and, yeah, in coming to a place of feeling that they belong and that they're contributing and that they're being heard.
Yeah, this makes me think of what's known as expatriate literature. And that really focuses on a distance from place rather than a location within it. And I was thinking about Hemingway and his notion of transplantation and how he extolled this use of distance as a literary resource. The idea being that writers who leave their countries of origin and then write about it are able to do so with a measure of detachment that heightens creative ingenuity, that allows them to see their own country better, to write its emotional history with a greater perception and depth, to see the Colossus from another angle kind of thing. And it occurs to me, as we're talking about the characters in your novels, that your characters are doing that too. You know, when Ming is in New York and when Nancy is in Paris, aren't they also, you know, looking upon their home countries with slightly different eyes, perhaps?
I think, yes, I think you're absolutely right. I would certainly say that of Ming. She's seeing what's good and bad about her home country in many ways, just from the perspective of being away and seeing the West and seeing what's good and bad in the West.
Yes, and that juxtaposition is presented with great clarity when you compare her with the experience of Han, her brother, who does not leave China.
Right. Oh, actually, he does go to Harvard Business School. He leaves China just long enough for that. But for him, China is where the opportunity is. So he goes back and starts a private equity firm in China after getting his MBA. And yet both countries are kind of suffering from this disease of capitalism, of excessive, of capitalism run amok of the 0.1% versus the 99%. The aim that Ming and Zoe are pursuing with their magical partner is to turn both China and eventually the United States as well back to what they see as a golden age. You can read, you know, Chinese philosophy and literature, and you will see references to a golden age in which, you know, philosopher kings reigned, in which scholars were the most respected people. You can read about New York City in the mid-20th century and the world of Greenwich Village, writers, poets, artists, theater, all of that. And it sounds to some of us like a golden age. Now, that's a golden age from the perspective of certain people. And was it really golden? I'm sure not for everyone, but Ming and Zoe actually are trying to make over their own environment because they have this magical opportunity to do so. So that was kind of my playing with the whole concept of place and thinking, what would the ideal place look like to me? And what would it look like to these characters?
Well, I'll just add too, I think I buy it, what Hemingway is saying. I think it's always safe to say that you're on board with Hemingway, right? I think that this idea of writers sort of, sometimes it's like writers in exile is one category that we might talk about it, but just sort of outside of their sort of normal space or traveling or in some other foreign land. This is like that, you know, it gives distance, of course. And so what you do exactly with that distance, you know, you can think critically, you can sort of, you know, observe things that you wouldn't otherwise have noticed, perhaps. Same with coming back into a space, of course, after having traveled and had different, you know, had a sort of shift in perspective internally. I think that that's astute of him, and that you can really get a better grasp, a better handle on those tiny telling details that you need for works of fiction that you might not have noticed if you're just every day passing through the same space and you take them for granted and they become, you know, you don't even see them until you have a little bit of this distance.
And it's interesting when this theme becomes synergistic between the fiction writer and the characters within that writer's work.
Yeah, it is interesting. And sometimes these things happen and you realize, oh, you know, 200 pages later, it's like, oh yeah, that's exactly my situation. Or, you know, I was living through that at that time. I wasn't intending to incorporate it this way, or I didn't even notice that it was unfolding that way, but, you know, it has.
And I was thinking of Nancy's perspective when she's visiting her mother's friends in London and her, you know, sort of seeing their traditions and their home life, you know, sort of through her eyes of an American, is also really interesting.
Yes. I like those little subtleties, I guess, you know, that you know, they're all speaking the same language and, you know, it's basically from the same heritage broadly, but there are all these little differences that make a difference. And it's fun. It's fun to incorporate those and make some, have some texture, sort of microclimates, as it were.
So there's also sort of a delightful connectedness between both of your works where, you know, the individual who pursues a path that is not direct to sort of corporate profit or to sort of financial success is somewhat suspect, and perhaps they need to be gently steered in the right direction.
Right. Yes, you're never going to come, you're going down the rabbit hole here and you might not make it back out. Yes, yes, that absolutely happens.
I was listening to both of you talk about your characters and place and not being able to go home again, as you say, Jan, and that saying, every time you cross the same river, it's a different river. This is what's so nice about fiction, at least in my opinion, is that you get to, we get to experience these places and through the characters' eyes, and they come alive for us in the small details. Even as Janie was mentioning to you, Karen, about Nancy visiting her parents' friends and their little rituals of having tea, after, you know, their tea and having their yogurt. And these are all very, what I would call, details of life that make us feel we're there. And so place can be a big place, like a big city or a different country, but it can also be a small place. It can be someone's kitchen and their cultures and their habits, and all of that is creates a sense of place as well.
I had my book open to that section with the yogurt and the and Daphne and Bob. I could read a bit of it if it's appropriate.
Oh, do. I wish you, please do. I think that we want to hear from Daphne and Bob. I they're two of my favorite characters. So please do.
Okay, so the setup is that Nancy has, her mother has suggested that she go and visit friends of the family to kind of keep them company over Christmas, and this elderly couple named Daphne and Bob. This was your mother's idea, Daphne informed me later. They'd given me a grace period of a couple of days. She and Bob were spooning cherry yogurt into their mouths. Dessert. I rested my spoon. What was my mother's idea? Daphne, Bob growled. He shook his head. Well, she has no intention of listening to us, Daphne said to him. She's up all hours, zoned in on that laptop. She doesn't do anything else. I think Lauren is right. She goes running, Bob offered. I think she's taken a few photographs. She's taken a liking to that coffee shop, too, the one on Magnolia Street. What was my mother's idea? I demanded as politely as possible. What is she right about? Daphne said, let me put the kettle on first. My mother had asked me to visit Daphne and Bob, not for their sakes, but for my own. This much I'd already figured out, perhaps even during that first deep sleep, though I wasn't sure what to make of it. I felt guilty for worrying Mom. I felt angry, too, that she'd come to this conclusion. I was so unable to look after myself that an elderly pair of strangers had to be brought in as reinforcements. Or were the Pluitts her meager solution to my supposed loneliness? Well, I was lonely, okay, but not desperately lonely, and I failed to see how eating yogurt with pensioners was going to solve anything for me, even at Christmas. I sat in grim silence with Bob, waiting to hear the kettle whistle. I managed not to smack my forehead against the tabletop. Daphne returned, carrying her tea tray. She set it down, poured us our milk, adjusted the tea cozy, and took her place at the head of the table. My mother thinks I should give up on my PhD, doesn't she? I said. Oh, no, no, I don't think she dares think that, said Daphne, reaching over to shake the teapot. It's your dream, dear. Mothers these days seem to think it's their duty to promote their children's dreams. Promote, 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 like cheerleaders. She's as subtle as an elephant in drag, Bob murmured to me. Daphne gave him a stern look. She's worried about your mental health, Nancy, for lack of a better word. Something's happened to you, dear. Something's going wrong. I'll leave it at that. But it turns out, of course, that Daphne and Bob have a lot to say. They're not in terms of what Nancy should be up to.
Yes, they do. They care deeply for her and they're concerned. I have another question. I don't want to take us too far off task, but in both of your novels, you've written about actual places. I know Sunshine Village is not the name of the small village, but how do you feel about creating fictional places versus working from a real place and inhabiting a real place that readers would know and recognize? I don't know, Jan, do you have any thoughts about that?
Making a village fictitious, of course, is freeing because you can make things up. The streets don't have to be aligned exactly as they are in that place. Or if it's a place that's from the distant past or in the future, or it's in your imagination, you can basically be the city planner who designs it as it is. And of course, that was important in Sunshine Village because I did become the city planner and I created a whole new layout for the town. In fact, an airstrip and all these tourists arriving, a whole new spiffy downtown, a place where people can shop and whatever you buy, whether it's hardware or a pair of Jimmy Choo's shoes, you just pay based on a sliding scale according to your income. So those are things I had to make up. But the way Sunshine Village actually looks, that's based on a real village, and that didn't change so much. I do think that verisimilitude is critical. You have to make the place feel believable, whether it's real or fictitious. And that can be just as much of a challenge with a real place as with a fictitious place. You know, there are many layers of truth, even in a fictitious village. I feel like it has to look like something I've seen before so that I can imagine the weather, the sights, the sounds, the smells, the kind of people who inhabit it. So you have to put in that truth. And yet, at the same time, whatever it looks like has to be driven by whoever is observing it, whoever's head you're in at the time. As I say, Ming and Zoe see Sunshine Village in very different ways. And the other thing about a place, when you're designing a place and you know, deciding how you're going to depict it, whether it's real or fictitious, I think that it probably develops as a character in itself. I'd hate to set a story in a completely static place. And, you know, that could be because of the people and what they're going through. It could be because of the weather. Weather plays a big role in Sunshine Village because, of course, it's an agricultural village. So it would. So I do think that whether you come up with a real or fictitious place, you have to fully imagine it. So if it's fictitious, you really have to play God with every aspect of it. You know, what kind of soil does it have? Does it have good drinking water? What kind of trees grow there? What kind of houses are conducive to the landscape? A lot of planning.
I find that really interesting, Jan, too, that you describe not only the environment of the village itself, but the way the village evolves over time, much as a character would do. And then the way the village is depicted differently according to who the perceiver is, that does really elevate the village to an organic creature almost, very much a character, which I think is marvelous. I've got a question for you, Karen. When you're describing the tea and the yogurt at Daphne and Bob's, it made me think of Flaubert's statement that the idea for Madame Bovary first came to him when he imagined a woman in a silk dress the color of a woodlouse. But just as certainly, just as critical to the narrative is the fact that the woman wearing this dress resides in a small provincial town in the remote corners of Normandy. And of course, the location of Madame Bovary is a significant driver of the action of the novel and you know, part of her desperation to be anywhere else, you know, other than that very provincial location in which she finds herself. So I wonder, Karen, whether you see setting in that sense really propelling the action, particularly of your protagonist, Hannah, in British Malaya. I mean, to what extent is what happens to her, without giving anything away, not preordained, but suggested or ingrained with a certain kind of momentum because of the particular environment she's in and because of her particular personality and her independence and such?
Yes, I do think so, because setting is, it's not as if it's just a physical space. So it's layers and layers of different relations, right? I guess for lack of a more precise word, but you know, the cultural context, the social context, the political context, all of these things are at play in whatever geographical location you're in, which of course also has in Hannah's case, the particular jungle that she's traipsing through to paint. It has in her case, this expat community and their expectations, their mores, their, you know, which they brought with them into this environment, and are sort of have adapted also for this environment. There are various constraints, maybe we could call them, or frameworks or something in which she finds herself. and so she has to navigate this, and or tries to navigate all of this to the best of her ability while, you know, trying to pursue what she wants to pursue, to, as she would put it, make a contribution. So she wants to paint, she wants to even almost more than paint, she wants to be able to soak everything up and experience it and appreciate it and to elevate it with the art that she's doing. And of course, these cultural, social, and political constraints, they can bog you down. And in her case, that does happen. It's very difficult. So it become, they, you know, the setting in that sense is one of the obstacles that this character is facing, and provides that, you know, that engine of conflict for a lot of the trajectory in Hannah's story.
Oh, yes, absolutely. And you know, thinking about place in literature and thinking about removal from place when we were talking about expatriate literature, there's also this notion of evolving place perpetually within the course of the novel. I'm thinking of Jack Kerouac's On the Road, where Sal Paradise is an American of Italian descent, and the novel is widely believed to be a thinly veiled autobiography, with Kerouac being the son of working class immigrants from Quebec. And there is this notion that the novel itself is a story of Kerouac's own search for a place as an outsider in America. And of course, in that novel, the highway and the movement is really the important aspect. And I wondered, Jan, you referenced On the Road in Miss Ming's Guide to Civilization.
Yes, not by accident.
No, and I didn't think it was by accident. I think that nothing in your novel is by accident. I found it particularly resonant because Ming, like Kerouac, assuming, of course, that they can be read autobiographically, is that Ming certainly seemed to feel herself to be on the margins of society, seeking a sense of belonging and a sense of meaning.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. There's no particular reason she should be on the margins of Chinese society, except that she just doesn't want to be the things that present day or recent present day China want her to be, which is a person who gets an MBA and helps make their country wealthy and strong. There is a lot of pressure, you know, and they more or less middle class in China these days to do that. And so she's kind of a product a little bit out of her time. And she does, as a matter of fact, have a burning desire to take a road trip across the United States because she's read Jack Kerouac. Not to jump too far ahead, but when she goes to New York, she marries a guy. It's really a marriage of convenience so that she can get a green card. But he's a great fan of Jack Kerouac. And they talk about getting on the road and just going to see things and just going to discover. She thinks of Jack Kerouac himself very, very pointedly as a figure who set out to discover the meaning of life, to discover, you know, where he belonged, just to ask questions instead of go through life with all the answers. One of the other devices I bring in there is there was this paradise. There was this whole other place outside of planet Earth that is part of my novel. And it's a place called Nirvana. There is another character I haven't talked about, but he comes from there. And he says that Nirvana used to be a place where people could drink and love and contemplate the meaning of life. And that sounds like paradise. But then a lot of people with big money bought their way in and changed it and turned Nirvana into a place where real estate is really expensive. And Jack Kerouac, when he came and knocked on the door of Nirvana, couldn't get in because he didn't have a business plan. This is all my novel is very much about the quest for discovery and this kind of ceiling. You know, it sometimes runs up against, at least in contemporary times, when your big concern is, can I afford to do that?
I read this interesting article by Professor Leonard Ludwig, professor of English at the University of Maryland, who's the author of The Role of Place in Literature. And he discusses some implications of dislocation as a creative theme, with the idea that Earth and the body and architecture define boundaries that protect humankind from the terror of disorientation threatened by undifferentiated space. Almost like this notion that when protagonists are detached from their homes and removed from their normal environments, if they're on the road, like Jack Kerouac, for example, they have more power to live existentially. They can recreate themselves anew in an exotic place or through a series of movements from place to place. So I guess it's this idea that, well, you know, architecture and place might protect, it might also confine and restrain, you know, according to the expectations of that particular society.
Mm. I think it's also about who you take yourself to be, about identity to a certain extent. So, you know, I remember the feeling of, say, moving, you know, to start school in a new place and, you know, nobody knows me here, you know, I can show up on day one and I can be the person that I've always said I'm going to be. And I'm going to, you know, like my apartment is going to have this and this and this. It's like all the stuff that, you know, you were meaning to do, or like, depending, you know, how radical a change it is and what the new environment is, you may sort of engage in that kind of active identity manipulation or change or whatever, or it might also just sort of culture shock and disorientation change who you are in ways that you're not anticipating.
That notion of adjusting to place too, for an individual who finds oneself in a new place and sort of figuring out what are the new norms and the expectations and such. And both of you tackle that in terms of your characters who are adjusting to new space.
Mm-hmm. That's true. It's almost like you're almost like a goldfish that grows as big as the space you're in, you know, but if you're in a new space, you have to grow with it.
It's rather a fascinating interaction between character and place that is constantly changing and evolving and dependent on so very much, which certainly makes it such a dynamic element in fiction. And I think that becomes particularly clear when you really talk about landscape and environment in a three-dimensional sort of evolving way, as you have done with Sunshine Village, Jan. It's novels where a setting is really elevated to something more primary.
I mean, I was thinking about Sunshine Village before we were talking today, and it is a character in its own right. That's a very ancient character. It's an ancient soul. but then it becomes a new revolutionary outpost in Maoist China. Then it grows old and kind of decrepit and forgotten. I have a section where Ming goes back to Sunshine Village, and the first time Zoe sees Sunshine Village, when Ming and Zoe go there together, the way I think of Sunshine Village at that point is that it's like someone who's been abandoned and is just leading this kind of isolated life, and the environment has grown really messy, and Sunshine Village is like a character that's embarrassed about its own messiness. And then these two outsiders come in and see it, which is terribly embarrassing for the village. And then, of course, the village changes completely at the hands of Ming and Zoe. So it's almost like a character they meet and give an extreme makeover to.
That's a good observation, Jen. Just to build on that, in terms of women in locations where, you know, they're not enabled to achieve, but in fact the opposite, discouraged or actively opposed in certain circumstances. I think in The Parasol Flower and in many novels, the place is also the natural world. We haven't really talked about that so much, but the connection that characters feel with a forest, a flower, with a river, with, you know, all of that is a way also of going beyond this society that is constraining you or is judging you in a way that you don't think fits. And so for Hannah, for instance, and this resonates with my personal experience too, it's a, you know, to go for a walk in the woods is to be able to, I don't think it's so much escape that social location, but to see a horizon beyond it, to be able to put a foot outside it and feel yourself as something larger than the little role that you're in, potentially, in your social context. So place, I think, in terms of the wilderness, that sort of setting is very important in fiction as well.
This is just the last thought that I have to throw in here. You know, I've been reading a little bit about American settler literature and James Fenimore Cooper and his use of place. And you can see in the literature that it imagines the space as virgin and then subsequently as the realm of the newcomer. And unimpeded character movement through the continent allows the authors to imagine and portray the region as a static, undifferentiated space. So while they describe a transformation, in reality, they convey a sense of domination and control of place, of land, and of the people who originally inhabited it. So it seems that it's interesting in literature in this sense, the characters are invariably depicted idealistically. They're removed and almost above a sense of place, which seems to serve as potentially as justification for government removal of peoples from their sacred lands and for wars and the exploitation of the environment for economic gain that then ensued. So I just thought that was really interesting in regard to the perception of base and how that can really correlate to political and economic intent.
Yeah, humankind's domination of a place. I'm trying to think of other literature about that. Of course, there is a lot. But people are always trying to tame the place where they are, you know, perhaps less so in contemporary times because we've done it. Although now I feel guilty because I have characters who are trying to remake the place where they go, and not everyone who's there likes it. You know, I'm thinking about what you're saying there. And I mean, of course, taming the West, it's very much so much the story of humankind, at least humankind in North America in a certain period.
I was just going to say, Jan, it ties into your idea of, you know, when you're rendering a place, it is through the eyes of someone. So if you're looking out at the expanse of the West from the settler's eyes, who think that it's just an empty territory, you know, it's like a backdrop and they're going to come in and settle and do what they want to do with it, versus through the eyes of an indigenous person, right, who looks at that same location and sees with detail, you know, this is the blades of grass or the particular river, the particular trees, you know, in a certain location, or, you know, and knows them very differently than someone who would come in and see it as, you know, lumber that needs to be felled or something else entirely.
Oh, absolutely. I've even heard people in the financial world talk about vast land that's been sitting there doing nothing for centuries. So now it's time to develop it. So it's certainly a lot of fodder for fiction.
It's been great. It's been great. And thank you so much, Karen and Jan, for joining us today.
Thanks very much.
Well, thank you, Janie and Pam. It's been a lot of fun talking.
And for those listening in, Miss Ming's Guide to Civilization and the Parasol Flower can be purchased on our website at www.regalhousepublishing.com. The very best way to support an indie press is to buy books directly from their website, and we deeply appreciate your support. If you've enjoyed this podcast, please consider leaving us a review. We would love to hear from you. From all of us at Regal, keep reading.